My name is Stephanie. Some people call me Steep. That's my nickname here, S-T-E-E-P. I answer to both. And little disclaimer, I'm fighting a cold, so it might take me a little longer to think. And I'm drinking two different liquids, so I might have a lot of bathroom breaks today. Anyway. Yes. Yes. We have enough chairs? And again, there's one over there.
You have an extra.
You want? Yeah. Just move that.
Am I crowding you here? Do you want?
No, I'm fine. Okay. I want to move that one prayer book out from under the chair. Okie dokie. So, we got tissues over here. Oh, good. Okay. I'm gonna need them for my cold, and maybe I'll cry, and I'm sure other people might. So we'll just have them around. Yeah. I was gonna bring blankets. So how there? Yes, thank you. Yeah, that's what scarves are. They're just colorful excuses for having a banky. Okay. So is this anybody's first time at the center? Okay. Anybody else's first time with this group, this class that's been going around? Okay. We're going to go around in a minute with introductions, but let's just take a minute to close our eyes and kind of, so this is something we do a lot at the center here, is just kind of like let everything else go and okay.
It's hard to see.
All right. Yeah, it's a tight little circle. I can certainly move, we can move it back.
I'm good here.
If we need to. And so the whole point of, is it too crowded for anybody or? Why don't we move back a little bit? Yeah. Because if I move back further, I'm probably be out of camera range, so I've got to sit still here. Right. Okay, so we were just going to like close our eyes, which is kind of like hitting the reset button. It's a little mini meditation. And time to let go of everything that you've brought in with you and just kind of focus on this conversation. So make sure your feet are flat on the floor and your back is as straight as possible. Kind of like coins balanced on top of each other so you don't have to hold them tight with your muscles. Your arms away from your body. The back of your head, you know, is the extension of your spine, goes all the way up there. So tuck your chin a little bit to make sure that that part is straight. And then put the tip of your tongue at the back of your teeth to relax your jaw and keep your mouth slightly open. And then just gently close your eyes or keep a little bit of it open so some light can get in. And just focus on your breath. And with each exhale, try to let go of any physical discomfort, any mental discomfort, any thinking forward, thinking backwards. Just try to bring all of your awareness to this moment. Feel your body sitting in the chair. Your feet, your sit bones, the skeleton which supports you, your breathing, which will be with you your entire lifetime. And count each inhalation, and one inhalation, one exhalation as one. And the next is two. And go up to five and then come back. Just for a little bit. Just again to set that reset button. And as your mind wanders to thoughts, try to notice that. And not stay with it. Just let them go. Knowing that you are not your thoughts. They're just coming in and out of you. And then try to rest in that moment between thoughts. And we'll just do this for a couple of minutes. And if your mind is drifted, see if you can really place it on this moment. It's kind of like surfing a wave that's moving forward. And notice your mind trying to go back or ahead of the wave that you're really actually riding. See if you can feel that energy of the present moment as opposed to the competing pull for future or past. And now we're going to take a moment to set our intention. So before we do anything, we have some intention, consciously or not. We have an intention. And in this practice, we're trying to be very aware of our intention, cultivate a certain kind of intention, and expand it. So let's start with ourselves. It's the easiest way. And it really roots it. So think first why you're here today. What's your hope? What is it that you would like to learn, share, let go of, incorporate? And once you have that real good handle on that, try to take a minute to think about how, if and when you achieve that, how it will help those around you. So if you're hoping to get more information, relax a worry or a fear, how that will definitely help you, and as a result, how it will help those around you. And then when you're ready, just slowly open your eyes. And am I still speaking loud enough for the camera? Okay. Hello, anybody at home? Welcome. So we're going to go around and just introduce ourselves to each other and say something. Give us an idea if perhaps you're a current caregiver of someone who's ill or perhaps you were, or perhaps like most of us, you will be at some point in this life. You will be around people who are ill or dying. So this particular conversation is focused on that, on helping others. You know, some of the others have been on our own dying, but today is in particularly focused on how to help those around us in different settings, different with different issues and illnesses and so on. So anybody want to go first? And then we'll just go around from there. All right. Oh, I could just pass this, but I guess we need a mic. Okay. So, yeah, we are using the mic so, because there are folks at home. It's not that you all can't hear each other.
I guess I'll go first.
by default.
So why are we
say your name
here.
And then anything that would help look, guys, this is just a relaxed conversation. I'm not leading any class. You all have an enormous amount of information and experience, and we're just sharing ideas and thoughts. And so it's helpful to kind of know where everybody's coming from and what are some particular things that you would like to talk about today and make sure they get addressed. That's my hope in going over.
So my brother died 10 years ago, and he'd been in an accident 9 years before that. So there was a lot of caregiving over those 9 years. And I wasn't directly involved, but certainly. A lot of it's coming up again for me, mm-hmm. and it's kind of around the house I inherited with him. I'm now... Anyway, there's just it's I'm just here to kind of dig into that more a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. Tell everybody your name. So I know to
Jeff.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Robin. And I'm a former labor and delivery nurse who's been interested in hospice care and done hospice training. I've been at many births. I've been at several deaths. And I have an interest, both selfish and altruistic, in hoping that we can create a community here to support each other through that process. You know, not there are people who are at ease in that situation, and there are others who aren't. And the more that I would really love to be able to be part of a care community here, both so that when few of us are fortunate to die quickly, be done with it, but most of us will go through some length of process where we are failing health. And I hope, and I know that there have been this is an ongoing conversation here, but to grow the kind of support that we need to help each other through that process.
Yeah, thanks.
My name is Kim, and the closest that I've been to a dying person happened to be my mom, which is probably not the best person to start out with or end with, but I guess one of the things that I'm interested in learning about, because I think we will, with intention or by default, be part of a community of dying persons sooner or later. So better with intention. I would like to learn how to better take care of myself during this process. I did it with my brother, and his description was, gee, it feels like we're on a mission and we're standing on a floor that has a trap door, and every day the trap door opens and you fall through. Then the next day you realize you're standing on another trap door, and it just keeps opening and you keep falling through. So we didn't do the best job of taking care of ourselves, and I think that's a huge gift to ourselves, and it's a huge gift to other people to be able to help them to see that it's possible to take care of yourself while you are helping someone else.
Okay.
My name is Helen, and I've had experience volunteering for many years, not presently, but for many years at a hospice in South Florida, and did a fair amount of pet therapy there and fundraising in addition to in-hospice work on a weekly basis. My goal in coming is not only for myself to help me understand even in a deeper level of what I had the opportunity of experiencing with others before, but I have a family member who is suffering greatly and is in the end stages of cancer. And with that family, I'm been focused today in coming here and thinking about the sense of loss, that even though he is not deceased, this constant sense of loss that they have. And my goal is, in when I'm called upon, I will be ready to help nurture and move into the space and flow with what's going on with the family. And they live a distance away, so I'm kind of like on call.
Okay.
Hi, my name's Hetty, and I lost my dad about a year ago after a long period of declining health, and through which, you know, we had various levels of care and support. I was never directly a caregiver, but dealing with his emotional process of going through all the losses that he had. He first became disabled, lost a limb, and dealing with the anger and that sort sort of thing, as well as dealing with my grief over the situation. My mother also passed away a long time ago, but it was after a 10-year period of declining health and MS and disabilities, and then in the end she went really suddenly, and just dealing with all the emotions and how you help the person through the fear and the anger, you know, that my mother experienced in the last weeks of her life over our treatment of her, because we gave her interventions that she didn't want, and yet she couldn't communicate, she couldn't speak during that period, and yet you could just feel her anger, you know, at, you know, why do we do these interventions, when she had clearly stated that she didn't want any intervention, she wanted to go as quickly as possible if ever something came up, and we weren't able to do that. So it's quite a process.
Right.
I'm Susie. 3 years ago, my mother died at 90 years old, and I took care of her the last 4 years of her life, and it was an eye-opening experience. She was often a difficult person, and in the end, I think it was a good experience. However, if I had had knowledge of Buddhism before that, I think it would have been better for me. I don't know about her. And I'm trying to let go of the fact that she had some unrealistic expectations about how long she would live, and dying, and not really facing the fact that she had a heart problem and she wouldn't address it, and she was dying. She was also very difficult. So I was talking with my daughter, saying, I won't do that to you. So the second part of what I'd like to do is know what I want, so that I can make it easier on my family, if possible, when the time comes. So if I have some warning, or if I get through all this whole process before I die, I can write it down, and they can endeavor, perhaps, to do what I want.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see.
Okay. Anybody else? Oh, sorry.
I'm Jill. So I'm several reasons here. I'm just sort of go with the flow, and the class is going on, and I come. I don't always have an agenda, so when it's here, I'm here. And I love talking about death and dying. I'm one of the weirdos here. So I think it makes me so much more comfortable in dealing with this. So I lost my mother 31 years ago when I was 21. So that was pretty difficult. But the whole process has been watching everybody and how you comment. I've experienced it for so long. So I've been able to go through all of those processes. And then my dad just moved away to a home with my brothers. So I've been caregiving for 7 years. So that's kind of an unusual feeling, trying to not feel guilty and feel good, you know, and have all, just working through all that. And I did get to take care of Susan Potter's mother. I was caregiving for her, so I did get to experience the whole process, and that was quite amazing. But it was also interesting information about someone who's not Buddhist and how to be real gentle and loving with them in their language. So that was a good experience. And then for me, it's just exactly what you guys are saying. It's just wanting to be clear and clear and clear about exactly what needs to be done, almost like the fact sheet, just taking it like, these are the facts, ma'am. Mm-hmm. So I can help my daughter, my family, do exactly like what Susie said. Mm-hmm. So that's my stuff.
Did you have any?
Yeah. My name is Patrick. Is this on? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right now I'm in the process of taking care of my brother, who had a stroke a few months ago, and for our family, I think that it brings up issues from death of our parents and my brother a few years ago, so that each time we have a crisis, then we sort of come at it from five different directions and have to sort of negotiate a way of working together to with the situation, and so that's one of the things that I hopefully work on or that I'm aware of is how often it's that we, it's almost like we have competing realities of who our brother is, or who our, you know, our parents are, and what the relationship was, and you have to sort of try and sort of respect that, and at the same time sort of be consistent with what my perception is of who I am and who they were or are.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the other part of it is, so that's the thing that is what I've been trying to work on, is to be how to be helpful to someone who is in the process of dying, but also be helpful to everyone else that's affected by that, who may be handling it very differently than I do.
Mm-hmm. So my name is Kara, and the first death I attended, I was 17 years old, and it was somebody I was very close to. He was my godfather, who we named him my godfather. But he was dying of AIDS, and I was lucky enough to be lying next to him when he passed away. Mm-hmm. I still get teary-eyed thinking about him.
Mm-hmm.
And this year has been hard. A friend of mine lost her son, and I was with her. He was 9 years old, and I'm a mother, and I have two children.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I'm really good in the moment. I'm really good. I was lucky that my first experience was actually really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It was really amazing, and I feel so lucky to have been a part of that. And I'm lucky that my mother actually was very open to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I also attend births regularly, and I find that very connected. There's a lot of similar feelings come up. So when I'm in it, I'm really, really good. I don't shy away from it, and I'm very present. And with my friend this year, she is not Buddhist, but she was open to certain things, and she welcomed my ideas, which was really nice for her son. I'm also the primary person, my grandmother's person here in North mm-hmm. Carolina. I'm sure some of you have met her. She's pretty funny. She's 89 years old. So, you know, eventually something's going to happen. It's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm so happy about this group. I think it's such an amazing thing to have.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm also hoping to, just what everybody's been saying,
mm-hmm.
like just be better prepared. And
right.
My grandmother is very open to any sort of Buddhist rituals
mm-hmm.
and things like that. So it's just nice to brush up on this, you
mm-hmm.
know,
mm-hmm.
and to recover from the deaths that I've attended
right.
and to be ready for the next one and
yeah.
things like that.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Anybody else? Can you just tell us your name?
Marina.
Okay, great. Thank you. So I've been taking notes because there's like lots of different ways we can go and lots of different things that was in the blurb that was put out. And some of the things, and let me know if there's others that I was kind of taking note about, is how to take care of yourself. Oops. I was wondering what that was. How to take care of yourself as you're trying to take care of others. How to help somebody who's dying. I mean, that's, I think, one of the big questions. We didn't really talk that much about it going around, but a lot of it is, you know, how do you help somebody? What's helpful? And how to help the family, and the family that you're in, or the family that you're helping. And I like this thing Patrick said about five different directions, because that's, you know, a lot of times also when it's a parent you're helping or somebody in your family, you're put back into this group of siblings that you might not have had to interact with for a very long time, and suddenly you're back in that whole gestalt. That sense of loss of ours, the person who's dying, their sense of loss, how to manage all of that. And then I have some questions like, you know, what gets in our way? What are the obstacles to getting there? How to deal with their anger that came up? How to deal with that person's anger and what's this? And their wishes. And if there's something else, just jump in at any point. I think the reason I got asked to do this, so there was also about how to make that person comfortable, how to work with their faith. So a lot of you already know this story. My mom came to live with me after Hurricane Katrina, made it impossible to live in New Orleans, and pretty soon it was apparent that she was suffering from vascular dementia. And so I was her caregiver in my house for about 4 years, 5 years, I don't remember, it's all a blur. And then she was in almost every facility you can imagine. In 1 year, I moved her 7 times. She was in a group home, then she was back with me with night care that I hired. Then she was in assisted living, then she was in the hospital, then she was in a private home, a nursing home. She had everything from bed bugs in one facility to somebody twisting her arm in another facility to domestic violence happening in a private home. She couldn't speak. You know, I didn't know what in the world was going on in her brain all the time. So it was extremely challenging. We had hospice care for 13 months because she kept, you know, she wasn't getting better, so we were able to continue with hospice care. Thank goodness. I had all kinds of issues with my brother and sister. So it's kind of like, you name it. All right, I guess I was there. And I think because one of the things that, and Chucky saw, because she stayed in my house for a little while, but right before she went to India. So I don't know that any of you are in that kind of situation or will be, but one of the things I learned was how to be really creative with somebody whose mind is not where your mind is. And I saw the value of, like, you know, if you have your mind, there's so much more you can do to help your mind. And if you don't have your mind, it's just really, really tricky. So I was trying to, and we'll talk about this later, but I was trying to plant certain seeds for her in the various stages of her decline that I could use during the moments of her death, and I was able to do that. So we'll talk about that. Just things that would help her relax, you know, and kind of go with the flow of what was happening. And she actually ended up having a pretty good death. The last couple of days of her her life were, you know, they were relatively peaceful. So I got pretty creative, and we'll talk about that. I mean, there's, for example, I'll just give you a little taster right now. There's this one mantra that's said to be very helpful to people on the moment of their last day. If they hear this mantra, it's very good. So I memorized it, and then I put it to the tune of O Shenandoah, so that I could sing it to my mom, that she likes that tune, and she was always happy to hear me chant that. And, you know, if she had her mind, I would be working with whatever worked for her, you know, but I wasn't trying to, like, push something on her, but I was also I was helping myself in that way and taking care of what was helping me in that. And also, she'd been at the center a lot, and Geshe-la came there and did some chants with her. So I found just these kind of creative ways to work with what was going on. Oh, it's a very long one. I'll sing it to you later if you want. Oh, Shenandoah. Om Chom Dende. Anyway, but I definitely will come back to this whole issue of how do you take care of yourself, because so oftentimes when people are dying, you think, okay, I'll be able to take care of myself because the doctor said they're going to die in a couple of weeks. And so I can stretch a little bit in these 2 weeks. And those 2 weeks turn into 2 months, and it turns into 14 months. And at the end of the 14 months, you're extremely wiped out. So sometimes you don't know. You think you're taking care of yourself, but you fall into this really dark hole, and you don't even know what's going on anymore. So it's almost like you need somebody else on the outside who's got the rope that can pull you back up now and then. So I want to talk about that too. But I thought what would be helpful in the beginning, because this question comes up a lot of, actually, in the death and dying class, in DB class, a lot of people were asking and were expressing kind of a nervousness of being around somebody who's suffering a lot because you don't know what to do. And you don't want to just pull away, but your impulse is to kind of pull away because what can you say? You're helpless. There's nothing you can do. So what I want you to do for just a minute is to think of a time when you were really struggling with something, whatever it was. You know, for me, it's easy. Those last several years were a nightmare. And think about something where you were struggling and there was nothing anybody could do to change it. It just was the way it was. And what helped you? What did you want from people? And of course, you'd want somebody to take it away. But aside from that, what did you find supportive, helpful, comforting, touching? You know, tiny little detail or something larger? And make some mental notes of that. And then I went to the bathroom. I want you to kind of pair up. Doop, 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 doop. Perfect. And just share those thoughts. And then we'll talk as a group in a minute. Okay? I'll turn this off so nobody hears me in the bathroom. Okay. What helped? What did you find, remember, that was helpful to you when you were big and small? You could make a list. What would some of the things be on that list?
Let me just throw one in since I got it.
Yeah, say it. I mean, I can repeat them here for the audience at home.
Okay,
if you just,
do it that way.
Unless you have something longer to say, you know.
Okay, we'll do
it. Yeah. Things that helped.
Mine would just be impermanence. I told Patrick that's just what I have to be reminded of constantly as a mother. With I mean, even if it's from a cut to, I call it my timeline, from a cut to death. here's the end, and here's a little cut in my finger. It's all going to change. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's exactly what I think I need to hear over and over and over and over, and someone to see when you need that and when you don't. But for impermanence, I need that pretty much all the time, I would say, for every circumstance I've been through.
Mm-hmm. What else came up for people that you remembered helped you when you were in a difficult situation?
Comforting words.
Comforting words. What were they?
Any kind of comforting words, really. It'll be okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you know what I think is the kind of universal thread in that comforting word is the intention. So when I was in social work school, they talked about there had been this big study about what kind of therapy was most helpful and what was the common thread and the different kinds of therapies and which were most successful, and they couldn't figure out why some worked, some were still working, but they used really different styles and blah, blah, blah. The common thread was that the person felt that the other person cared. And so I think it's the same thing. You could really maybe not say the best words, but the person feels that you care. Comforting words. Comforting words. And so that's why I train mediators, and what I always tell them is, look, you can do that technique perfectly, but if it's not rooted in the intention of trying to listen, it's not going to work. And likewise, you can make a whole lot of mistakes in your listening skills, but if you have the intention, people will get that. People will forgive all the little mistakes. And so I think what helps as we're helping other people is to get really rooted in that intention first and being really present in that. Oftentimes what happens, certainly with the mediators that I work with, is that they jump to the solution. Because we want it to get better. We want it to be over or whatever. So if we can stay in whatever is, no matter how difficult or uncomfortable it is, and you know, even be aware of our own nervousness and fear around it. I know for me, I couldn't believe how helpful it was just for somebody to call me up. And I had friends in New Orleans who called me once a month, if not once a week, just to hear the latest story. And she'd always say, okay, what can I do? What can I do? And I'd say, you're doing it. And I was amazed that people didn't realize that just calling me and asking to hear about all this was hugely beneficial because it showed their concern. I have a regular little lifeline out to the other world. What else?
That's what Robin and I were talking about, I think, being versus doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the tendency is to do, especially when we don't know how to be, we jump to
right.
do.
Right.
And so the first question people ask is, what can I do?
Right.
And the most helpful people for me were people who knew how to be.
Right.
And so they would walk in the room, you know, they would assess the situation, they would take care of things. I don't want to, don't ask me,
right.
what can I do? Because then that's another, I'm in pain.
Right.
I can't think clearly. Now you're asking me something.
Right.
It's well-intentioned, but you're asking me
right.
to put myself, it's a chore.
Right.
So people who can be are the most helpful, and just commiserate, listen, whatever.
Right.
With people who can be, it doesn't make any difference what they do.
Right. So for people at home, it's the whole emphasis on being rather than doing. And you know, I think the thing that helps us practice that is, again, single-pointed meditation, focusing on just being in the present, watching yourself trying to be pulled back and forth and just trying to rest in the present and not being afraid of our own discomfort with it. I mean, you know, there are things that are really uncomfortable, but again, that person isn't expecting you often to pull them out of wherever they are. I never expected anybody who was helping me to be able to change the situation, but just to be able to be with me, to be present with it so that I wasn't completely isolated and alone, is a huge gift, a huge gift.
I see it as sincerity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Someone who can really be there when you're present.
Right. Right.
And sincerely want to be with you and, if possible,
right,
help you.
It's a kind of witnessing so that you don't have to carry it all by yourself. You know, it's just somebody else witnessing it with you. And I think when it's that person's demise, illness, death, whatever, it's also that they don't have to do that completely alone. Somebody else is going to be right standing there next to them, even though you can't take it away. They don't have to be isolated because people are afraid to see it.
When my mother died, I wanted to know at the moment when the moment of death was. Mm-hmm. And the nurse came in and held my mother's hand, one hand, and I held the other. And as she was dying, she said, I knew the stages from hospice, mm-hmm, you know, what was going on perhaps. And she said, it's going to be soon. And it was so comforting,
mm-hmm,
to have experience,
mm-hmm,
who was also very kind.
Right, right. And to be tuned into what, to where you're at. So I thought all the years leading up to my mother's death that I would absolutely want to be in that room the minute she died. But when she got into the stages of dying, I could feel in me that that I was disrupting her. It's going to be different for every single person, right? But I was kind of just paying attention to the vibe in the room, and I felt like every time I came back in that room and did certain things, it disturbed. I mean, she was not alert, but I felt like it was disturbing her energy, that she was kind of trying to almost come back. So I just kept walking around the nursing home, and I'd come in and swab her mouth and then keep going for a couple of days. So it's again, trying to pay attention to you and the clues that you're picking up and your own sensibilities. And then we'll talk later about when there's five different going on in the room. Somebody else want to say something? The other thing I think about helping other people is knowing that, you know, there's a limit. You know, sometimes that's a painful thing to realize that there's a limit to what we can do. And I think it gets back to just remembering that being is a huge, huge gift, because usually people are pretty frantic in their doing, and that there's a big gift in the being. But know that there's a limit. The thing I came to kind of tell myself, again, somebody with the kind of illness my mom had, it was this very slow, slow descent. And I would finally kind of get it that, you know, this was her dementia. This was her death. It wasn't mine. And so I don't have to go into that same hole. You know, I can witness and help, but you don't go down into that with that person. Somebody has to be standing up on the side, like I said before, so that they're a little more balanced and healthy and able to help. I had to really remind myself of that a lot, that, you know, this was hers, and, you know, so able to help but still having strong boundaries, and know that that's her illness, and there's a limit to what I can do. That's her journey. That's her path. And I would tell her a lot towards the end that, because she was distraught and very upset about all kinds of things. It wasn't anger, I don't know what it was, because she couldn't talk, but it was a lot of crying and something I told her, it then helped me later. I used to tell her when she would be really upset and crying, I would ask her, like, maybe this time I didn't ask her. I just said, Mom, I want you to just think right now about where you are. You're in this warm bed. You've got, and this is when she was in a private home. I said, you've got great food. You've got people here who love you. Right now, you're okay. And she wasn't in any pain. And she kind of stopped, and I'd say, so probably you're thinking about something that's making you sad, and you're thinking about what's coming up. But right in this minute, you're okay, because it was late at night. She'd be like sobbing hysterically, and she'd kind of calm down. And then, of course, somebody here mentioned it, like, in that moment, you're fine. I think you were saying that. I'm fine in that moment, you know. Also, because I'd have to pull it together for this other person, and then I get in the car, and I was a wreck. Mm-hmm. And I drive home going, okay, in this moment, Stephanie, you are fine.
Yes,
you are in a car. It's warm. You're not walking home. But I... Right. I realized all these things that I was telling her were actually helping me if I could do them. So it comes back to that thing in the moment. And then I think somebody was talking about that trapdoor. Who was that? Yeah. So I had the best advice a doctor ever gave me, this was after my mom had been in the hospital, was to pace myself. Of course, that gets into the hard thing because you don't know. And I was always saying, like, well, how long do we think we've got? And turned out to be 14 months. But But I think that that is a good rule of thumb, is to pace yourself. You don't know. Also, I think you don't want to regret something. You know, you don't want to feel like this thing's going to come back to haunt me. But all of them together, like say I wanted to take a vacation. I've been doing this for umpteen years. I want to take a break. So I kind of weighed it all, like, okay, I could go to D.C. and still get back in time. I don't want to go too far that I would really regret it. I don't want to not go and, you know, not take a break from all of this. So balancing all of those things helped me. The trapdoor thing for me was, I don't know if any of you remember The Twilight Zone. Did anybody watch The Twilight Zone? Okay. Mm-hmm. The old one, Rod Serling, yeah. Do you remember the one where this guy, there's this shipwreck and the guy's on this, I think it was the Titanic first. So he's on this boat, he's having a great time, the ship sinks, he's on this, you know, I don't know, in the water, he gets plucked out. Ah, finally, he's safe, he's on this other ship, they get him tea, they've got him in blankets, he's like, thank God. And then, boom, that ship goes down, it's the Lusitania. And, you know, it's just this endless thing. If he gets rescued, then he's in another one. Well, I kind of felt like that. As soon as... it speeded up. And so, you know, there'd be one huge... When you're dealing with somebody who's declining, and you get to a point where you think, okay, this is good now. I finally learned to interpret what my mom's saying, and I've gotten these things taken care of, and we're in this setting, and then some catastrophe would happen. I mean, for me, it wasn't just a little change. It was like a nightmare. And then you, okay. So what I learned from all of that, though, was enjoy the blanket and the tea when you can, because another, you know, crap is coming up. So it is. And it's just like our lives. It's not that different. It's just that it feels so much more intense. It's like on steroids and speed it up, and you're responsible for this other being. So some people would tell me, they would give me kind of advice that I was like, look, I would feel this way if it was an animal off the street, but you know, now you're talking about my mother, I'm going to be acting like this. So it's not so easy. So really enjoy what you can. And when I look back on it, you know, yeah, I still went to the movies, I still moved for two times. I still did things. I still found ways to enjoy what was right there in that moment, you know, and then get ready for the next thing. There's another term I want to introduce here that I learned through all this. It's called ambiguous loss. So when somebody has died, we are grieving. We're, you know, mourning that. We know somebody is pretty much going to die. You know, they've got this illness, and We're in the stages of grief with them. When it's something where you have to be with somebody for a long time who's already pretty much checked out, like with Alzheimer's or dementia, you are going through something called ambiguous loss. And you can't really move into any of that grieving yet. And sometimes this just happens when you're a long-term caregiver, for those of you in that situation. It helped me enormously to know that, because you have to just kind of separate everything. And here you're just focused on all these tasks and you can't get into any of the lost stuff. And then you just kind of, when you're on your own, it helped me to know that's true. That's what I'm going through. When we're talking about how to take care of ourselves, I'd love to hear what people think they would have done differently in the situations you've been in, or what you would advise somebody else. Because I thought I was taking care of myself, but... you know, it took me probably about a year and a half to recover. And at the very end, when my mom was dying, I had shingles. So I had shingles all here. And shingles, you know, as you know, it's painful. And I couldn't cry. I mean, there's no way in hell I could cry, because I would just be like, you'd be like just throwing acid in my face. So I would go home from where, you know, where she was, and just go home and watch. I had got all these DVDs of comedies to watch. You know, so I could just like, I couldn't, there's no way I could cry. So that's how I got through that. Mm-hmm. But obviously, I had gone down to the bottom.
Karma burning like crazy.
What'd you say?
Burning your negative karma like crazy.
Right, but I almost burned completely out, you know. And so I think mine was exacerbated because I had no family at all. Here was just me. But if you can think now about what would you have done differently, what would you advise somebody going through a situation like that I went through, or that you've been through?
My sister and I were in a similar situation. My husband was dying, and my brother was in a 4-week coma at that time.
Mm.
And my sister took care of my brother, and I took care of my husband.
Wow.
And I think she took she was just so much better dealing with the situation.
Yeah.
She left work at 12 o'clock at noon and had to drive 4 hours by train to the hospital, was with my brother for 3 hours, and went back and came back at midnight at her house.
Mm-hmm.
And she did that for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it was just, when the hospital, they don't let you go in right away. And she would take a nice walk through the park or go to a particularly nice cafe and have a nice dinner, something
mm-hmm.
very special for her.
Mm-hmm.
And she felt that it would help her get energy
mm-hmm.
to go back to this comatose person and talk to the person who cannot react
right.
to anything.
Wow.
And I think she did very well with that.
Mm-hmm.
And she also, after 2 weeks, she decided she was not going to go it alone. I'm the kind of person who thinks I'm responsible for my husband. I have to do it all alone.
Mm-hmm.
But she started
yeah.
calling friends and family and said, who is willing to do this?
Wow.
And she assigned her son 1 day a week, you go. Another son 1 day a week, you go. A friend of my brother's went another day. And then she had to go only twice or three times a week.
Good for her.
So I think that's one thing you have to have the
mm-hmm.
ability to assign tasks to others and not feel that you have to do it all.
Mm-hmm.
I think she did very much better than I did.
Mm-hmm. What did you do? You didn't have that group?
No.
Yeah.
I didn't have the group, but also I felt
mm-hmm.
felt responsible, would have felt guilty
mm-hmm.
had I not done everything
mm-hmm.
myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I think she did better.
Yeah. I think it brings up an interesting point. Like sometimes, I think the way that I would advise somebody about to enter into what I did is go ahead and prepare groups or help or something, whatever it is, for different stages of what you're going through. And my father, who lives in England, would send me some money so that once every 6 months, I would go to just a hotel room so that I could, this is when she was living with me, and I'd pay for a caregiver overnight
mm-hmm.
so that I could have a bathroom that was mine for a night and didn't have to wake up 4 times. It was like I was in Tahiti. I was like in a little airport out by, I was at about the airport, a little hotel out there. One time I went to Chapel Hill. You would have thought I was in Hawaii. I was so happy. But it made me really appreciate, like your sister, that this was huge to be able to go and have lunch by myself or something. And I think now, I mean, I kind of am amazed that no doctor sat me down and said, here's what's kind of coming up for you and here's what you need to do. By that time, it was already, not really, it was already crunch time. And we didn't know if she was dying next week, next month. One of the hospice workers suggested I bring her back to live with me when I only had living in 2 rooms. So I was like, I can't do that. And I've just, you know, I think I'll die if I do that. So, no, but I started to enlist other people. I paid other people to go. And you know.
Something unusual, which I was so young, so it's like feels like a whole, which is another person.
Mm-hmm.
But I was 21, and so I was in school, and in design school, you couldn't just jump in any quarter. You had
mm-hmm.
to go, it has to be sequential.
Mm-hmm.
So I left school, and they said, the teacher said, if you don't come back and finish up and like crash course through the summer, you can't start next year because it won't work. So I was going to have to miss like a year and a half of school. And and I was really, my dad was there, and I was living with my parents, but my brothers were elsewhere. Kind of, everybody was coming in and out, so everybody was coming in and saying goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
All the uncles, all the cousins, I mean, like, and I was too young to have to. They would come out of the room, have it all together, and leave, and then just lose it. And there was me.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
trying to help everybody through this.
Mm-hmm.
So when she was ready to die, and I went back to school. Well, I didn't know she was ready, but I mean, we knew it was close. And 10 days later, she passed.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, so this is 31 years, I still feel really good about that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel any regret. It would have been, I think, too difficult for me to be there for the end. And everybody else needed the end because they didn't have the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And I had all of the throwing up and trying to find the bite of, you know, the pill she took and all of the stints and all the garbage that you had to go through. So I did all that. And then I felt good about leaving and I said my goodbyes, which
mm-hmm.
still seems strange. It still seems like, how did I do that? But, I mean, I think that really worked. So
mm-hmm.
I think not having to do what everybody else thinks you should do.
Yeah.
Just because that's what you're supposed to do. Being Buddhist, I might be different. I might think I could be helpful at the end. But I just wanted to say that was a
mm-hmm.
unique experience and so that I still feel okay about it. And I have a positive memory of being able to say goodbye to her alive.
Well, the thing is, you're still helpful in the end, even if you're not in the room. You know.
It's hard to feel like you are, but.
Yeah, but I mean, one of the things, that's what it so surprised me, because I was really the only person. But I, you know, and Geshe-la had said, you know, you're going to be just as helpful just because your thoughts are connected to hers. So you just kind of feel the situation. Some people, you and that person and you may need to be in the room for them. But, you know, she wasn't in the room.
You're right. Mentally,
I could tell. So the stages leading up to when they gave her morphine and she was somewhere else, I was in the room 24/7. And then they gave her that morphine, and then she really started the active stages. Then I just sensed that wasn't as important. And so, but I think you bring up a really good point of kind of being able to know, being able to shift. It's like surfing.
Yeah.
Okay, now the wave has changed. I got to put the emphasis over here. Now it's changed again. I need to do this. Being able to shift with things and not be stuck on what you think it should be like. It's going
to
be.
They all did what they needed to do, and so it was really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted that last experience,
mm-hmm.
and they got to say goodbye. So not thinking that I had to do what they had to do,
mm-hmm.
and they don't. Nobody gave me any grief either. So
that's
I think,
amazing.
Yeah.
So one of the ways to, you know, that we have, I think, that's really useful is to assess when it's changing and when you need to change is the attachment to what you are doing. Or what you were doing. I mean,
mm-hmm.
how strong is your attachment? Because, I mean, a lot of what we're talking about is just letting go.
Mm-hmm.
Not just letting go of the person, but letting go of your piece of the process
mm-hmm.
and what you were doing, what you should be doing, you know, whatever, 15 million different opinions. But your own opinion is the strongest, so you're going to have the most attachment to that. So the assessment tool is how attached am I to being with her at the end death, and that's my stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That helps you see what's your stuff and what's your stuff.
Right.
We've got a great assessment tool.
Right.
They even tell us it can be difficult with someone you love so closely,
mm-hmm.
because then you might have a hard time doing
sure.
and letting go. So
yeah.
We know that.
Right.
Having studied it, that may not be the thing we need is someone in the room crying.
Right.
And we can ask for that, right? We can say, if we could.
That you don't, yeah, sure. I mean, we're lucky enough now, we can kind of script it.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I'd like, this is what I don't want, you know.
True.
And that, again, is difficult if you're trying to help somebody who hasn't thought it out or now their mind state's changed so much, like somebody who has dementia. And just trying to be able to assess, what do they need? What does it appear that they need? What do I need? What's the difference? You know, what am I projecting onto them? And what's simply their needs and looking at it and being ready to shift. It's not easy, but you know I think our, you know, if you're really paying attention to your own gut, not just what you're thinking. I got some news the other day. I was really worried about a friend of mine, and then I realized that all my energy was kind of like way up here, and I just sat down and tried to relax and meditate, and it all felt like it's going to be okay, you know, because. It is what it is, and I'll be able to be what I can be for that person. But when you start to feel that everything's tensing up like that, to me that's like the biggest gift, is to be able to just go somewhere and try to relax that, because you know you're not going to be helpful. There's a couple of great books that I'll just recommend now. I read them in my 20s. I'm not sure what drew me to it. But the guy's name is Stephen Levine, Levine. And one of them, I think, is Meanings at the Edge. One is Who Dies. He's got a very Buddhist, he never uses that word, but just a very open approach to working with people of all different faiths. They're very short chapters, some of them. He's talking to people who either are dying or a mother who lost a child to a murder. I mean, all kinds of things, you name it. And his whole focus is on being present. And he said he'll walk into a room because he doesn't know the family. He sees all of their chaos. And the person sometimes in the bed just looks at him because he's just so relaxed and there, because he doesn't have all of the history with that person. And then he's like a huge comfort to them because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think some, again, is knowing, well, I may not be able to do that because of my feelings, so who else could I get in here to be that for the person? You know, and that's why a lot of times I had a friend of mine died, and he did not want his family members to know. He just wanted to be with hospice. He felt like that's exactly where what he would get from them and not his family.
I got to experience that with Susan's mother. She told told me things that were so deep after months, 8 months of being together. I was so honored. I mean, she was really sharing things, and I didn't need to be shared with everybody. It was just stuff that she needed to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just that, it was easy to be calm with her because I didn't, but she was my mother's age, so I got to kind of have I just thought about that experience again.
Mm-hmm.
But someone who, when you're the one in the room who's not involved emotionally, they can tell you everything.
Right.
Slowly.
Yeah.
I think that relieves her pressure.
So what gets in our way? We're talking about where we'd like to, you know, what helps, what has helped us in the past. Can you think of anything that kind of gets in the way of being that? Or potentially get in the way for something coming up that and you'd like to be more centered, more being, more in the moment. Because I just think it's a good to know that. It's a good, you know, you can work on it now and just be prepared. Like, that's what I know will be a problem. That's what I know will be an issue. What will I do? How will I name those people who can help me? How will I take a break? How will I, you know, what you think will personally get in your own way?
I think I have a hard time with, I'm lucky, I have such an amazing community and family that I feel confident that whatever I go through, there will be people offering help.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I have a hard time managing that help because some people might offer help that isn't very helpful. And I'm so grateful that they want to help, but I'm not sure how to say, this isn't helping me. It's actually making things worse. So I don't know the delicate way of...
I have a similar thing where people will start to tell you the story of their parents' death or their neighbor's death, and they're off in their own world. And they're not helping me, and they're not helping themselves, it seems, either. I don't know, depending. And so to be able to say, hold that thought. I need to go do something else. You know, or that really is a problem for me. And for some reason, I seem to draw people who want to tell me all about their experience when it's not helping me.
I think that's really common,
though.
I think, you know, our experiences trigger other people's experiences.
But to know to be quiet, say a little, or ask, is there any...
But what do you think...
What can you say to someone?
But why do you think they're doing that?
I'm not sure if they know. They may be thinking they're helping.
What's the most common? You know, somebody... give us a scenario where that's happening. Where that's happened.
Someone in the nursing home, I'll say, oh, my mom has blah, blah, blah. Oh, yeah, my mom, blah, 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 blah.
This is another person like you?
Another person like me, or someone I might know as a friend who may not be a very close friend, a neighbor. They want to tell the story, their story.
But haven't you ever experienced somebody like somebody who's had... Or any one of us, like if somebody died, somebody close to you died, and we kind of all kind of recognize that they need to tell a story. You know, you need to tell a story.
But if they're trying to help me, who someone is dying, and this person died 20 years ago.
Right, but if they haven't completely resolved all of that stuff, then
that's
trigger.
That's what you say, I'm helping them.
Well, it will trigger stuff that they don't have resolved yet, so they're not going to be thinking, well, you know, you shouldn't put that unresolved stuff that I have on her. I mean, that's not going to happen.
It's like pregnant women telling other pregnant women how
birth
is.
But you know,
they're trying to resolve their own grief, and unfortunately, you know, you're in the way.
But I also think...
Way,
I think sometimes it's competition. I have the feeling that people on the show, well, you have this pain, but I had more.
Or
very
my
often, because I have
too,
listened to people, their stories. The next person chimes in, the next, and it always gets worse, 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 and it's funny competition.
There's that. There's definitely that. I think another way to look at it, or maybe to try to change it when they're doing all of that, is I think a lot of times people are trying to tell you that you're not alone. That, you know what, my mom's also going through
that.
I think they then maybe kind of go on because of their unresolved stuff. But if you wanted to nip it in the bud or something, I would say I'm so glad I'm not alone. thank you.
That's true.
You know, I think that sometimes there's mixed stuff. Like their intention is probably not to just, you know, bash. Their intention is good, more than likely. They want you to know you're not alone. I understand this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've all seen, like, where people get really upset. Oh, you don't understand this. I've heard, it's kind of interesting because there's these two responses. Like when somebody tells you something terrible, one person will say, I understand. The other person will say, I can't imagine.
Yeah.
And, you know, which one is more helpful to you? Which one do you
the
like to hear
one.
Better?
You know, the one that's true.
Well, it depends on if you want to be the one suffering the most. Sometimes we're suffering the most in the room, and sometimes one other. We want it all.
I don't know if you
can. Someone says to me, I don't know, I don't understand, or they say, I have been through that. As long as it's true, they might help me.
Well, the people who are telling you their stories are trying to tell you, I've been there, I know what it's like. Now, it may not be that they've been exactly where you are. Nobody's been exactly where you are. But I think, again, it comes, a lot of people are very uncomfortable seeing other people suffer, which is a good thing, right? And so they're trying to quickly move and fix it by telling you sometimes, well,
yeah.
I've been there too,
yeah.
And this is what I did.
It's not an automatic. You
mm-hmm.
have some people have a story that they always tell. My husband,
I feel like I have.
We're all
seeing everyone now that microphone.
Yeah.
But
think of it as, all right, this is their way of helping me and telling me I'm not alone.
Yeah. You might try to interrupt it then and say, you know, I'm glad, you know, to know I'm not alone.
Mm-hmm.
I just, you know, whatever.
I have to go to the ladies' room.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Yeah, it's always
mm-hmm.
a good one.
Mm-hmm. But also, what are you asking for when you tell them? Why are you telling them? You know, what
I
do you
ask?
Uh-huh.
Or I'm standing next to my mother. You know, sometimes if I tell someone, then yes, I am asking for their companionship
mm-hmm.
in a sense of what, how is their life going
mm-hmm.
in the same vein.
But that's what they think. They think they're doing that probably. I mean, really, that's
how we do. So just try to be aware, too, of, like, what you need if you're initiating conversation. So you can often say, I've said this to friends.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need, you know, any to be fixed or any. I just need somebody to listen to this. Do you have a minute?
Yeah.
You know? And then all the other people, like in their nursing home or something, you can kind of manage that. But, you know,
I wish I had done it better, and I think now I could do it better.
Yeah. But I know from my years going in there, it was kind of nice to hear somebody else's story. And we would all sit around, you know, feeding our parents and like, can you believe this? And blah, blah, blah. And it was like my own little support group right
yeah.
there, you know.
Oh, she said it.
Because we all had that same shared experience of, like, I lost all her clothes, even though they have a name on it, you know, whatever, whatever's going on. Just like pregnant moms, right?
Right.
You know?
I took a client to electric shock therapy if you want to experience some hell realm. And so we'd sit in the hallway for 5 hours waiting for your client to go through all what it takes to go through.
Mm.
So every time somebody would go in, all the caretakers were sitting there. And so it was I actually wanted to get a job there saying, can I just have a room? And because we needed so much help. But it wasn't my family member. So I started talking to them because they needed to tell their story.
Yeah.
And so I just let everybody... And then I would start hooking people up. And like,
Yeah.
She just told me that. But they all needed to talk. And it was so difficult to have somebody going through this and to sit here in a hallway, which was the worst.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't even a room we had to go in. And so I think everybody, that's just what we do. We tell,
mm-hmm.
we tell stories.
Well, it's like a gift to listen to someone sometimes.
Well, that's what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
The gift of being present. So, you know, yeah. Expanding our capacity to be present, you know, and knowing what it is that we need in a certain moment. What are any other obstacles to helping or to any of the things that we've said that help us? What's our obstacles to doing that?
Fear.
Yeah.
I couldn't be in the room when my mom passed. You know, I left an hour or two before she left because,
mm-hmm.
you know, we all knew the outcome and I couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
That was 15 years ago. I still feel
mm-hmm.
still feel bad that I wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think it's probably good that you couldn't, that you weren't there, that you knew enough to not be there.
She wasn't alone.
We
had lots of family members there. I come from a large family. We were rotating through the rooms. So.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you missed something that you would have felt differently had you experienced it?
No, not really. Not really. But I just felt like it was a personal shortcoming that I couldn't face it to be there. You know, I didn't want that to happen.
Right. It was the fear that you felt and was at the kind of root of that. So what's a good way of managing fear? And what is our fear? I mean, I think I'm just asking these kind of rhetorically, you know, to help us look at our fear. As soon as I get some bad news about somebody's health, I can just feel like fear rising up like a flagpole. And now it's all up here. It's stopping my thinking. It's got me looking at a certain direction. And then if I can kind of like, I know for me what to do sometimes to try to get away from that. But it just puts these blinders on me. And anybody else? For me personally, I need to be alone. I need to sit down and just center my body because I don't feel like I'm very physically grounded sometimes. And when fear enters in, I get all up in my head and start worrying. So I need to get away from everybody and just really do some deep breathing and try to remember the bigger picture. And sometimes, you know, just coming back to some guiding principles for me that help me with that bigger picture. I need the bigger picture view. And then I can go back to like, okay, what can I help in the smaller picture? What can I do in the smaller picture that will be helpful? Probably being tight and fearful is not going to help anybody. So how can I try to keep this bigger view as I move through things? And I know like when I meet with clients, sometimes what helps me stay grounded, because I'll pick up their feelings and then we're all a mess, you know. I carry this little stone and I'll just try to hold that stone in my hand, and that kind of is like a physical reminder to stay more grounded because somebody in the room needs to be grounded. And that helps me.
Great idea.
You know, and so if there's anything, you know yourselves. Find things that help you stay grounded in your best mind, in your best sense. What's your best self? What's the way that you want to be in that difficult situation or when somebody is upset, you know? And then find ways to stretch that capacity, practice it. You know, I practice it when no one's around so that I have a little more experience with it. I'm very acquainted with my fearful self.
Okay.
So I want to get more acquainted with the grounded self, and then how can I bring that in? And then I just keep practicing it in little situations. And you know a great place to practice it is movies. So in the movie, we get all caught up in this drama and this trauma, but we're in a completely safe zone. You know, we're sitting there in our living room or in the theater. And then we can try to practice, like, you know, trying to have a bigger view. It's a challenge because that little camera's got you all like going down there and the cars crash. So I just try to find all kind of places to practice and see if those abilities will grow. So, yeah.
I was just thinking that when I feel out of situation, getting like hunkered down, you're very intense within yourself and in the suffering. If I could somehow within myself think, let my mind go to the spot that someone is always suffering and they are suffering more, and whatever I have no control over the situation.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing the best I can. I'm feeling frustrated. Just offer it up to those who are even less have the ability.
Right.
And if I could just get myself out of myself for a moment, just a moment, just flip that switch, kind of push it. It at least starts lifting to get out of myself.
Right. Good point. You're less isolated.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would be lots of different ways. So, you know, like a friend of mine recently got a diagnosis of stage 4 liver cancer, and she said she just started thinking all day how many other people were getting that same exact diagnosis that day. You know, that helped her get it out of just her unique little, and made her feel less alone. You know.
And also sharing the idea that someone is never alone.
Right.
I may not be in the room with you. I may not be in the state with you.
Right.
But you are never alone.
Right.
I'm always thinking of you. I'm always sending positive energy.
Yeah.
And positive thoughts.
Yeah.
I'm planting that seed.
That's wonderful. You know, that reminds me of something I read the other day about some writer was writing something he or she told to their loved one as the loved one was dying. And usually, you know, we're feeling that we're going to be left. This person is dying. And this person, I thought this was very clever. He said, you know, you're not going over there alone. You're not dying alone. I'm going to go with you, meaning my thoughts are going with you. You're not going to do that alone. I thought that was really interesting. I never heard of that before, to say it like that and to think like that. And it gave that other person a lot of comfort, you know.
Sort of to flip that around, one of the things that comforts me and the people that I've lost is the positive memories of them that I keep with me, and nobody can take that from me.
Right.
You know, their physical body might not be here. I can't talk to them.
Right.
I can't hug them, but I have all those wonderful memories.
Right.
That doesn't go away.
Right.
And that's a huge comfort.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, depending on what your beliefs are, if you believe in reincarnation, then you're going to be with them again and again and again. And so making the hope and the wish that it will be, you'll be able to help them even more, and they'll be able to help you even more. So you're going to raise it up a level. I remember when my dog died, Geshe-la said, sounds funny because it's a dog, but I've used this with so many different situations of people dying. He said, just make a really strong wish that she's in your very first circle of disciples when you reach Buddhahood. I was like, oh, and he was so serious, and you know, I was like, okay, I'll do it, and it's helped so many different people I know when they've lost somebody. You know. Yes, well, I think it's because, you know, if I was able to help her so much in this life, you know, maybe I'm, who knows, who's ahead of who, but yeah, yeah, right, and so planting the seeds, I want to come back to that, so if you're with somebody, and again, it's going to depend on what you know about them, your relationship with them, but think about the seeds that you want to plant when they're... So for my... I'll just give you my example. So, again, my mother would get very distraught, and she didn't believe in anything, so it was very hard to talk to her about what might comfort her, right? So I knew that she had been a yoga teacher, and it was very into her body, so I'd say, we're going to do a meditation now, so you're going to have to slow down the crying, focus on your breathing, and she would do it. That she would do. She'd focus on her breathing, and I'd give her a visualization of floating down a river, and I was just trying to kind of plant the seed of, like, letting go and going with the river as opposed to holding on to the shore. And I'd give her these visuals of, you know, floating safely on this river and around the bend. It's beautiful. And, you know, if you just stay here, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then I'd give her a big visual of how beautiful it was around the river, the end, bend of the river. All these people she knew were there. And we'd go on and on with all this stuff. And I started that early when she was living with me and did it all the way to the very end. And I'd like to think that that was helpful. It was my way of trying to move to where she was in her mind state and use something. The other thing I used, because when she taught yoga, she would come around to whatever position you were in, and she would say, she'd like touch your arm. You really don't need to keep your arm tense. It's not helping you at all. You're using your legs. So why is your arm tense? Or she'd come around and, you know, you'd have your jaw clenched, and she'd say, that's not helping you. You know, those aren't the muscles that are helping this position. So when she got very distraught this last year, I would remind her of that. I said, do you remember that? And I don't know if she really did. She'd nod. And I'd say, so right now, your upsetness is not helping you. It's just like those tense shoulders, you know. And, I mean, it's not that I didn't want her to cry, but it was just, it was endless, and it wasn't helping. You know, it wasn't like she was just grieving something. But you find their language, what worked for them, and then you just pay really attention. Is that helpful or not? And it depends on if they can communicate with you, then, you know, you're talking about it all. And even asking somebody, like, what do you think will help you when you get scared? So we're talking about our fear, and say you're dealing with somebody who's coming up and going to be dying soon. What about their fear? What would be helpful for me to remind you of? What do you want me to do as I walk with you down this path? And then you can be more prepared to do just that.
I was lucky for my godfather's passing. The rules were sort of set up ahead of time, as you mentioned, where he told everyone before he went into a coma that he said, I don't want anybody angry, mm-hmm. and I don't want anybody afraid in the room with me.
Mm-hmm.
And he made that very clear, and he said that to us, his me and his clique of people. And, so when he did slip into a coma, we were very protective of that, like, yeah. because he made it so clear ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it was my father who showed up, and he just immediately started crying, and he's like, I can't believe this is happening. And we, you know, two of us just took him out into the hallway, and we're like, we need you over here right now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this isn't going to help.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on? And it was very, like, and he got it, and he walked away, and we just kept his room almost sacred, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's no fear or anger allowed in that room. And, in fact, we found ourselves laughing, like,
mm-hmm.
next to him,
mm-hmm.
And sharing really great stories.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
But I think it's because he made that so clear to us. And
mm-hmm.
I hope my grandmother can make that clear
mm-hmm.
as to what her wishes will be.
Mm-hmm.
I think that helps a lot.
Well, it sounds like a good baseline for everybody, and then when they're trying to have just a good vibe in the room and not anger or fear.
Yeah, and I think if we hadn't set that precedent, it
yeah.
might have been harder
right.
for all of us to be on the same page.
Well, and sometimes culturally, in certain cultures, it's almost you're expected and you should wail, or else it's really perceived as being disrespectful, almost what the enormity of what's happening.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what my father was coming.
Mm-hmm.
He was Puerto Rican, and he
mm-hmm.
had a very Catholic upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
He came in and
right.
this is what we do.
Right.
And it was like,
right.
Think about it.
Yeah.
My husband's father died recently. And we knew he was dying. He had multiple myeloma for 10 years, and so he lived like 9 years longer than he was supposed to. And at the end, he just didn't want pain, and he was set up the way he needed to be set up. And my husband's stepmother was in the next room at this facility. And Corky was in hospice. And at the end, the stepmother would not leave him for 3 days, and she is elderly and sick, and she was getting angry, and she was hard to deal with, and we weren't in the same state. We were trying to get there, and the nurses were upset. There was nothing we could do to pry her out of there, and finally, my husband's sister was there, and she was texting us saying, she won't leave him alone. She keeps bothering him. She tells him to hold on. You know, things that weren't helpful for a person
mm-hmm.
Who really was in the last stages of dying. So what I did to try to be helpful is, and it worked, is I called the stepmother and I said, please put her on the phone. And she was so tired and punchy, it didn't make any sense. But I said, I need you to leave the room and go into your room so I can talk to you, because I don't want Corky to hear.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And then I kept her on the phone for about 25 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And his sister was able to say goodbye.
Mm, great.
But I guess what I would want for myself is that if someone was out of hand like that, to have the ability to have someone come in, either not a family member or whatever, and steer them out.
Well, I think you did it very cleverly, because otherwise, you know, you almost sometimes make things worse.
Mm.
Trying to pull a distraught, grieving
much worse,
wife away.
Right.
You know,
they get angry.
Right.
My brother died out in Denver. All the kids went out there, but he was living with a young lady who was homeless and had moved in with him, and she was, I think she had a lot of problems, including mental health problems, and so she was just losing it all the time that she was there, and screaming at us, you know, get out of here, and, you know, of course, my twin brothers are like, who the hell is she, or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. And so, you know, social worker, I'm like, okay, got to step in, the whole thing. Well, the other social worker on the unit, we were in a hospice. Luckily, he was in a hospice because he was sick enough to be in a hospital unit,
mm-hmm.
which is unusual.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they were fantastic. So the social worker, she's like, she pulls aside, and I'm like, okay, well, I'm a social worker, but I'm the sister, so
right.
I got to step aside. She says, you know, the person who's dying, your brother's dying here, but don't forget, he is still a player.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, uh-oh, and I'm like, oh, good for you. And she said, you know, so the chaos that's going on in his room, he's involved with making that happen.
Mm-hmm.
So just because he's dying doesn't mean that he isn't a player in what's going on around him.
Mm-hmm.
Don't discount him. And which was, you know, a really good thing to hear, because we were trying to, you know, we were trying to manipulate the situation so that she could calm down and that we could have some time and the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which eventually we did, but I mean, we were able to have some time because they intervened. But
mm-hmm.
But from my perspective now is that, you know, that was his death.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you're saying, like,
mm-hmm.
his was his and mine's mine.
Mm-hmm.
And he, for whatever reason that I don't understand, because I'm not him and I don't have his karmic push behind me, he needed that to happen at his death.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's not, I don't think it's our place to always feel like we have to come in and, you know, make things, you know, the way we would like to see them, or the way it should be, or whatever, because this is what's happening with this person.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it might not be comfortable for us, you know, we just have to respect what's going on,
mm-hmm.
and not add to it.
Right.
You know,
by trying to change it.
Hard enough.
Right.
I don't think it's our place to necessarily expect that you're going to now direct how, you know, all of this should go, and that's easier, much easier said than done. But just
that's a good point.
Them and what's going on, it might not be pretty.
Right.
You know, we bring our expectations.
Right.
How we think it should be.
Right.
And they're all different. There are expectations.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you can recognize that, the fact and allow them to have their death.
Yeah.
Well,
that's a perfect story.
Did that. He told you what he wanted and helped everyone.
Yeah, and it's one thing if somebody's told you and asked for some help creating that environment, and then I think it's a really good point. You
so
know,
when they're creating chaos.
Right, that's what they're creating.
That sounds so nice.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Geshe-la's talked to me about, you know, when somebody's in the stages of dying or somebody's in a coma, from a Buddhist perspective, they're even more sensitive to thoughts. And so if you really want to change the situation in the room, but you can't, and even trying to would make it worse, you still have your own mind, your own thoughts. So you can still try and do as much as you can with your connection to that person, with your connection just to sanity, you know, and just try to get rooted in that and not even more wound up in whatever's happening in the room. And, you know, and communicate to the people that you love and care about now about what would they like if they're fortunate enough to have a slower death like that. How would they want the room set up? What would they like? What would be difficult for them? What do they want to be reminded of? It's a really powerful conversation to have.
And I think it's very difficult because my mother, for example, she's turning 90 now in very good health. That she doesn't want to talk about
right.
it at all, because talking to her, mm-hmm. like having a last will, is like making the final step in tomorrow's
right.
life.
Right.
So she would rather push it off because she thinks she can extend her life.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so then you need to just, you know, respect that, and because you'd actually be causing her more harm to have the conversation, you know. I had a friend who, when her mom was, her mother-in-law was ill, and she was... oh my God, she needs to know this. Everybody, we need to talk to her about this. But when they, you know, really her mother-in-law didn't want to talk about it. Her mother-in-law didn't want to hear that she was dying. She wanted to not be told any of that. So you'd have to respect that. That's where that person wants, and that's where they're coming from. And that's probably going to make that an easier death for them.
Mm-hmm. Which I see that she never once, the whole time I was taking care of her, said that she was dying.
Hmm.
Which, and I had, so I did that. I had to say, this is almost painful for me, but it didn't matter because I was just a hired gun. So, like, it didn't matter. But it was hard to say, we're not going to ever talk about it. Because she didn't even say, we're not going to talk about it.
Right. But you're coming from, like, completely different worlds.
Let it be her.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and sometimes for those, I mean, I've seen this before. I don't know about it for Jesse, but they are talking about it in their own way, but they're never going to use the D word,
right.
you know. But for them, you know, sharing all that stuff with you, processing it, but not in the same kind of way that we might. And so that's where it comes back to just being present.
Her experience. I had
yeah.
It was a really
good lesson for me. I really like have a lot of control over that because that's it's so much easier when you're hired versus when it's family.
Oh,
so I think it was great for me to experience it because I mean, I was really close to her, but that doesn't even compare.
Right.
Just letting her, and we would get out the pictures, and I'd let her tell every story 100 times.
Right.
So, I mean, that was her way.
Mm-hmm.
But we never could talk about what was the death. So, you know, it was mm-hmm. nice to say that's not going to be her experience.
Mm-hmm. One time with my mom, sometimes you get little caregiver psychic ability going on there, especially when somebody can't talk. So one time, she was in a private home, and there was nothing different about this night. I mean, she was declining, but she wasn't on the brink of death, but she just couldn't stop crying, and I couldn't understand what she was saying, and finally it just dawned on me, and I said something like, "Are you scared?" And she's like, "Yeah." So I tried to reassure her, and then all of a sudden it dawned on me, she thinks she's dying tonight. And so I just decided to say, like, "You know, you're not dying tonight. I mean, you might, but you're not." She looked at me like, "Really?" And I said, "It doesn't look that way, Mom. I mean, you're fine. You're eating. You're sitting here. You had a full meal. You know, we're good tomorrow. I was going to take her on this little walk." I said, "I don't think you're dying tonight." "Oh." And, you know, yeah. So sometimes it's really, as hard as it is to get into that person's, instead of trying to pull them over to where you are, you know, try to go over there and see it through whatever, wherever they're at, you know. And you'd be surprised what little bits of wisdom might come to you. You know?
I think that's what helps me when you think about what helps. And something about, somebody said, when you're afraid to fear, if you just finally ask yourself, well, what am I actually literally afraid of? Because mm-hmm. just being fearful is like that. It doesn't do anything. It just sits there and it makes you feel like, but if you literally say, well, what am I afraid of? And what am I sad about? What am I scared about? And you answer those questions, then you don't feel like you're, it's an unknown. And it feels like somehow you can kind of deal with it if you make yourself say it out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And can I control it?
Yeah, what's the worst case scenario?
What can I do?
Play that out.
So yours, you know, and then the person you're dealing with, harder, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, but if they can have the conversation.
Do you think that's helpful if someone could say, what are you
Again, it depends on that. I asked my mom at one point when she was not quite as far gone. She said to me, she was that this is not what she expected. I was like, yeah, I bet. You know, she lost New Orleans and all that. So this is not what I expected, you know, life to be like at this point. So I was kind of glad she said that, because then later I could talk about it a little bit with her. But you know, it just depends on what you know from the person. And it might be helpful, and you might ask them, would it be helpful to talk about what you think might be coming up and what you're afraid of, and how can I help you? You know, what do you want to be reminded of? What would help? It's impossible to know. Anything we didn't talk about on the list? The different settings. So, you know, you might be in a hospital and they've got their rules. You might be at home and can do all kinds of different things. If you have hospice, they can really try to go to bat for you. I was able to leave my mom's body. I wanted to leave her body untouched for as long as possible, and they helped advocate for that. And she was in a shared room with like 4 other people, but we were able to leave her for like 6 hours. So that was pretty stunning. And they also didn't touch her. They just called me and said, you know, we're pretty sure she's dead. So then I came over there. So you just try to...
You asked that of them ahead of time.
Yeah, but I mean, even the hospice nurse said, you're not going to get that. And I said, okay. Because you can only, I mean, I accepted that. I accepted that.
What is the reason for that, not having a touch?
Just my own personal beliefs. As a Buddhist, the last thing I wanted to be able to touch her head and say some prayers after she died. But they're kind of used to hearing different things for different people in different religions.
Mm-hmm.
And the hospice nurse said, no, they're going to test her hard and do these things, but they were so used to me, and they felt really bad because they had moved her. They had to move her to a Medicaid room, and this is what started her decline. So they felt a little guilty. So that worked to my advantage. But you know, like that. Okay, so I don't know really why I'm telling you all this, but it's just in case it's helpful.
Mm-hmm.
you know, the room that she was in, other people with dementia, those last couple of days, I wanted to be with her. People would come in. They don't remember they've just been in there. They're coming right into your little area. And, you know, it was just a nightmare. And so I was about to lose it. And I was telling the nurses, you know, can you help me with this? Can you get them out? If somebody just moved these people out to the area where there was an activity going on, they wouldn't come back in the room.
Right.
So finally got somebody to kind of redirect them. But that took, again, advocating. You know, and, or having somebody to advocate for you. So half of it's just PR with the nurses, you know, and getting everybody on your team, not being a pain in the ass.
Right.
Do they ask you for their, I guess, directive? You know, like when you get rid of a baby, they ask you, you give them your birth plan. And they,
can you have a death plan?
They held it to me. Yeah. So do they, can you present a death plan?
Again, you're working with their facility, so there's different shifts of people. You might not even have the same people who've got it. Again, we've just been moved to a different floor. You, be ready for anything.
Yes.
Hope for the best, but be ready for anything. And
so this wasn't in a hospice
situation? Yeah, hospice comes with you to wherever. If they prefer that you be in your own facilities because they've got a limited space. But
and they're not there all the time.
So hospice, not, yeah.
Missouri. Yeah. Father discovered what my understanding of hospice and what they were calling a hospice was like
different.
It was completely different. I mean, it was like we were speaking two different languages.
It was hospice care in a nursing home. The hospice team would come, I was still pleased. I mean, I had this whole vision that we'd be in our own little room. At the very end, hospice was asking me, do you want to see if we can try to get your own room? But I didn't want to move her again. So we just pulled the curtain around the bed, and I had my own little vigil there with her. But I guess my whole point of that is trying to find the best way to advocate. And tricky. But I still feel lucky. It's like surfing. I think I could pretty much surf now. Put me on the ocean.
Ocean's easy,
yeah. Right.
Have you ever surfed?
Anything else that we said we'd talk about that we haven't or you'd like to?
Well, just all those different perspectives.
Yeah.
The family, the brothers, everybody's opinion, negotiating all that.
Yeah.
I think what I was struck by also is that, you know, with the Buddhist, you know, perspective in previous sessions, it kind of sort of oriented towards things to do, both for one's own, but also for others. And but I found that then, and I think the focus of that is also being really sensitive to what the person is most helpful for the person, and striking that in terms of being there for that, and then as opposed to having a kind of this, you know, going having a checklist.
Right.
So this has been helpful for me to sort of back up a little bit. And, and say that's still something to work on, but it's not.
Right. It's a little different shift and focus, yeah. Yeah.
But you know, I think it also depends, in my case, my husband, who was diagnosed with cancer, and she knew he had a year. So we had a lot of time to prepare and explain things and stuff. But if some people have a stroke and it happens all of a sudden, the situation is completely different.
Right. That's right. That's right.
I would think so. Having all these disparate views that you're with around this time, because everyone has used the very artful term of expectations. Everyone has their own expectations of how something should be. But in trying to be observant and quiet and use skillful means in dealing with everyone, to try to pull people together rather than one brother going this way or sister going, trying to just
very quietly pull people together to move in the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
But very skillfully. Mm-hmm. It requires patience and watching and waiting for that window open where you, as you use the word, plant a seed.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully it'll come onto fertile ground, that it'll grow in the right direction.
And be ready for it to not.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Or, you know, people are in really different places, and people are comfortable with very different things. And there's a lot of guilt and fear and shame, and it's just a family, you know, and old history rules and roles that people got used to just come, you know, flaring back up. And there's very little time to process it in a crisis.
When you get one shot at it.
Yeah, well, yeah. You might have more, but...
But at that moment, you know, there's not.
Yeah. And you have to, you know, find... Just being sensitive to your own reaction. And so here's another story. I feel like one of the people you're talking about trying to trump somebody else, but I'm really not trying to do that.
Not in that category.
Guess what happened to me next?
They're not.
But so I was in England visiting my father, and my mother, who's in assisted living, had fallen. She was in the, they called me. She was in the hospital in restraints, trying to hit people, couldn't swallow. My brother and sister live in Louisiana. My brother was supposed to be on an emergency call to come in case, I was visiting my father. I wasn't off having a holiday somewhere. So he was supposed to come and take my place if any emergency came up. So he didn't. My sister didn't. They both said, well, my sister was busy. My brother said, well, all she needs is somebody to hold her hand, and it's not, you know, anybody can do that. And so I called then friends of mine who went there while I was in England. The day I get back, my brother and sister decide to come. And I think, looking back on it, I think it was because of their fear.
Fear.
But for me, I mean, I was, well, I think they felt better. I was there. I'd been handling it. But I was furious. Furious. And so I just had to figure out what to do so that I wasn't going to explode all over them in the hospital. And most of it was just leave the room. You know, let my mom have her time with them, and then go out and then try to talk to them a little bit about it so that I wasn't just a raging lunatic. But, you know, then almost every single thing I asked them to do, they didn't do. So, you know, being ready for all kinds of crap to hit the fan no matter what, and trying to keep your eye then on the prize. What's the point of all this? The point is that my mother needs some help and blah, 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 and I don't really need to get into it with my siblings, and finding a place for me to deal with that somewhere else. You know, so that I can deal with this right here. And
I think it's okay, you know, to sometimes be present to your emotions too, because a lot, you know, so many of them come up.
Right.
You know, stories. I was lying next to my mom because we were taking turns. You know, she was so sick on the floor. She had a hospital bed downstairs. She wakes up, rings this bell because that's the way you communicate. Ring the bell. I'm waking up. Like, what's going on? And she's like pointing her finger at me. She's kind of like, your brother needs to get here. And you're the one who's going to bring him here, and I'm not going until he comes, you know. And, you know, my first reaction was like, oh, crap, you know, don't do this to me. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not for why me? Now, yeah, like, why me, you know? I mean, give me a break. And I felt guilty right away, you know, because here she is, she's sick, you know, all this stuff. And my reaction was, give me a break. You know, you're doing the same thing you're doing. And, of course, all the same things happen. Same thing you've been doing all my life, and now you're doing it now, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Why change? You know, I mean, she's like, crushed. I mean, she's got lifelines. But, you know, I beat myself up for having that reaction. Now I realize, you know, that's silly, you know?
Right.
Of course, you know, you have these reactions, and getting angry with the person who's dying is another reaction that's totally understandable, and you just have to let yourself feel it, and you don't have to express and react to them, you know, like you say, take it somewhere else. But perfectly okay to have all kinds of reactions, including negative reactions, to the person that you're trying to care for.
I think it's part of that plan, you know, so you can try to have the people who are going to help you, but can also know that, okay, I'm going to have all kinds of reactions. I'm not going to be a perfect angelic creature in the room. So I'm going to need to find, you know, time and places and whatever, room, mental room, just knowing that I'm going to have these reactions and be able to watch them and go, okay, now you can kind of sense that one's coming up. So, yeah, I take myself out of the room, call my friend, rant and rave, you know, get back in the room. Whatever you need, it's that's self-care. Mm-hmm. That's self-care.
Also, in anticipating, I think that's an excellent point you made about this, you know, like you're doing this and you've done it before, that often I found that, and this is true for all of us, often our worst qualities that we've had in life, you know, being angry kind of nature or, you know, always a lot of frustration very easily, gets exasperated.
Right.
And this is true for all of us when we are in pain, fearful.
In a crisis situation.
So almost anticipating that whatever
right.
you've seen in life will come multiple souls
right.
out.
Right. I think that's a good point.
One of the things that happened in my family, and this is kind of an opposite view, but during my mother's final weeks, we drew closer together and we found a huge amount of humor in everything that happened.
Lovely.
You know, we were able to laugh together over almost every, you know, the fact that my brother and I shared a bed, a single bed, you know, because he spent the overnight shifts in the hospital and I the daytime shifts. So, you know, while one would get up and the other would get it.
Yeah.
Like, and we had things to laugh about, you know, all the time every day, you know. So we did take it. And that reflected my mother's personality because she was, you know, she loved everybody. She loved, you know, having fun and she loved laughing. So, you know, and we had not been particularly close for many years because everyone was busy raising children and everything. Mm-hmm. And that really drew us closer together. And we've been really close ever since.
Wow.
So,
that's,
I mean, I just, you know.
It's a nice story.
Happened too, you know?
Yeah.
A friend of mine recently lost her mother about a month and a half ago. And a similar thing happened with her. And she had that experience of her brother and her sister weren't helping out as much. She became the primary person to be there for her mother, and it was a very unexpected illness that came up. But it's, I think, from beginning to end of the month. So it was very sudden and quick, but she still had time with her mother. And she said, you know, there was one day when she was particularly angry about, like, her brother not doing anything, her sister not doing anything. And then in the middle of the night, her mom woke up, and they had this really lovely talk, and her mother was brushing her hair, and she's like, you know, and she had this moment of like, I was given this as a gift. Like, I'm able to have these moments and that helped her so much. And after that, it was a lot easier. So,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Isn't that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I liked hearing that one.
Thank God our car overheated when my mother passed. And we were in the funeral line going to her. But that thing was thinking of something funny because it was just so funny. We had to pull off the road. And it made everybody start laughing and we're always usually pretty silly, and so it was extremely helpful.
We had a train come during the funeral. It was a freight train.
I've heard people say, you know, especially if there's some time to their siblings, you know, I don't want whatever tendency theirs is, I don't want to be upset with you. I want it to be us coming together and just kind of putting it out there. We can kind of go either way with this, but I hope that, and let me know if I'm doing something blah 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 bossy or whatever. So I think there's some times that we can try to change that. When we can't, we just figure out what we can do in that moment.
That comes back to your intention.
Right.
That's not hearing what you're saying.
Yeah.
Not respond well to that.
Right.
Well, you could. People can, but that's their. They can think about it later.
You try, but like what I did in my situation was I just tried to.
Where they responded badly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think my brother or sister would have, you know, changed their tune, but because But what I did was I try not to focus on that disappointment, and my hospice team was incredible. So they were my family, and they went way above and beyond the call because I had to make all these decisions by myself at the end. So they would show up and sit down with me when they wouldn't have normally done some of those things, they told me, but they knew I was kind of solo. So I just tried to think about that, and that really, you know, my siblings loved my mother. They just couldn't be there. You know, so.
But you respected what's really going on behind the scenes, is you can see that they couldn't handle it. So right. There's no reason to be angry at somebody who can't handle it.
Well, there are, but.
But
I mean, I can have my reaction. I can have my reaction, but I don't want to live in that reaction because it's going to be a nightmare. So, you know, I think most people in my shoes would have, you know, kind of gone off the rails. But, yeah.
My brother's been helping me for 7 years, and people that I tell the stories to, my story that I tell, they would get furious. I'm like, that's not helping.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I know they're not doing anything out of malice. But finally, I spoke up because I'm still the little sister at this age, you know. So finally, at one point, I asked for something, and he said he couldn't, whatever. And I said, I just, you know what, that really bothers me. And I just, I've been doing X. And it was no anger. It was such a beautiful moment. And he just said, I don't know what to say to that. he had no way of knowing that I was going to speak up for myself. And so it was not done with any anger. And I think that was really helpful to just say, right now I'm just going to say, I'm really frustrated. And then it was like, because then that's all it was. I need to let you know, basically, that you're not doing anything. But I said it real nice. And he was speechless, which was lovely. And so so being just honest in that moment with myself, I didn't harbor any anger. Because I knew if I hung up, I would have been like, you know, and I could have vented, which I have done with other people, but finally it felt good to say it.
So you weren't face-to-face. That's even harder.
Yeah. That was a really nice moment. It feels clear. So that's what I was going for, is how to not feel sticky when you're going through this, is not to have that stuff just hang on you.
Patrick, were you going to say something?
Well, I just was going to say, when you're talking about the hospice team, one of the things at the beginning, when you're talking about what helped what helps me in terms of not getting overextended is that it's like developing an extended family. There's all the people that have been helpful in taking care of my brother and helping me make decisions and doing this and that and the other thing. So I really try and focus on that.
Right.
I sometimes feel badly that I'm not just sort of at the end of the day or beginning of the next day just going around saying, well, I want to thank you. Just going around saying, thank you.
Right.
Because there's so many great people.
Right.
And so focusing on that, I feel like I'm, that it isn't, you know, that I'm carrying the weight of,
You're supported.
Yeah. So anyway, that, which I find helpful, and I'm talking about that with my family. Giving that a sense of everything positive that's going on.
Yeah, so definitely important to create your own team, create your own family in these situations. So that's our dinner bell, time to leave. Let's just take a minute to think about, you know, our intention when we walked in and sat down, and that it took effort to come here on a Saturday and talk about something difficult. And I appreciate everybody's energy and sharing and courage. And if the seeds that we planted in this effort, they're golden. So this is a moment then to dedicate where and how you want those positive seeds to grow. So think of things in your own life, obstacles that you would like removed, ways that you would like to share good energy with other people around you. Just like we raised our intention to the highest level, we try to raise our dedication to the highest level. So start with yourself and then see that those good seeds growing further and further around you. People you know, people you don't know, people you like, people you don't like. And And then thank you very much for your time and energy. Okay. Thanks.